91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we speak with the Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association, Matthew Schwartz. What's the outlook for those with environmental concerns as state and federal regulations are cut or reworked? Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. It's easy to see that human population in South Florida is still burgeoning. How will more people affect wildlife, water, and climate issues along with lessened regulations? Oil prospecting in the Big Cypress National Preserve is well underway. The Florida panther species could possibly be removed from endangered status. And the Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant is a candidate for expansion. So stay with us. Topical Currents up next after the news.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's today's Topical Currents. Well, this hour we get an update on South Florida environmental issues from the Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. He's Matthew Schwartz.
Just a few of the topics we'll discuss include the status of expanded oil and gas seismic exploration in the huge Big Cypress National Preserve, which begins about an hour's drive west of Broward County.
Also, after decades of protecting the precarious existence of the Florida panther, its endangered species status is under review.
They'll also touch on nuclear power generation and high-powered electric distribution in South Florida. Welcome, Matthew Schwartz.
Good to be here, Bonnie and Joe.
Good to have you with us.
Okay.
It's always good to have you. I just wish your visits could be filled with good news, and they never are. It's hardly the case. So, as you've said, we can see the rampant development in our urban areas, but many of us don't know what's happening where things are more out of sight. So let's begin with Burnett Oil Company's victory in their search for oil and gas in the Big Cypress National Preserve, and what's going on from here?
Well, I guess a victory from Burnett's point of view, just to back up a little bit and say, let people know what Burnett are doing for folks not familiar with the issue. So Burnett Oil out of Texas has leased 235,000 acres of the Big Cypress National Preserve, well, 235,000 acres of mineral rights that are held by Collier Resources inside the Big Cypress National Preserve. And that lease is for seismic exploration as well as oil development should they decide to go that route. They've broken it up into phases. Phase one was a 70,000-acre seismic testing survey that they started this spring after we, as South Florida Wildlands and other organizations, sued and unfortunately lost our lawsuit that happened in April. They went ahead after the lawsuit was finished and started working throughout the dry season. Once the rains came and the preserve got inundated, they had to stop the operations. But they will be back next dry season.
Now, the judge's ruling was on the exploration for an okay. It hasn't yet approved that there could be drilling
or pumping. So every phase, every activity would require a separate permit. What they got originally was a permit for seismic exploration and specifically on 70,000 acres, roughly south of I-75. Most of it's I-75 in the center of the preserve. We sued. The judge ruled on many, many issues that we were wrong, that oil drilling is an allowable activity inside the Big Cypress, that Collier Resources does, in fact, own these mineral rights. They have a right to lease it to this company. And the fact that the seismic trucks that are going to go in there, vibrate the ground, and pull out.
How much do they weigh?
They weigh 60,000 pounds each.
The trucks.
Each truck weighs 60,000 pounds. They're moving through the preserve in pods of three. And I was in there during and after they worked, and I can tell you I had never seen an impact quite like that because I've seen ATVs and ROVs, off-road vehicles, in there, but I've never seen ground, that soft, spongy, Big Cypress wetland soils, flattened out to where it felt like almost concrete. It was hard. And what that does in the future, how it springs back, I have no idea. And 70,000 acres, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of miles of trails like this.
Now, Burnett has claimed that they have not and will not harm the preserve. What is the, I don't know if it's the science, what is the fact of the matter that you, as you know it?
Well, we think that there has already been harm to the soils of the preserve. what happens to those soils, how they could possibly recover those soils that have now been flattened out and have lost their structure is a work in progress. We also don't really know what the impact to wildlife was as they were driving around through there, panthers, eastern indigo snakes, all kinds of listed critters in there. There were helicopters flying all over the place, dropping off geophones. I mean, for the time that they were really in operation, it was an industrial site. That's what it looked like. That's what it smelled like. That's what it sounded like. And it's pretty hard to go out there with a microphone and say, Mr. Panther, what do you think about all this activity in your habitat? I should mention there's another project like that that's coming up, and that's just north of the preserve. That's a different company called Tocala. So Tocala is not on our list. And so you're looking at the list. Tocala is a new one. It's 100,000 acres northwest of the preserve, also in Florida panther habitat, but not inside the Big Cypress, just on the northern edge of the Big Cypress. That's another 100,000 acres that have been leased from Collier Resources to another company to do more seismic testing. That one's going to use shot hole drilling. So instead of the vibro-sized trucks, which drive over a piece of land, stop, vibrate the ground, these folks are going to drill holes in the ground, put pentalite, an explosive down there, blow it up, and pick up the seismic signals from that. And, of course, all of this is a prelude. I mean, these guys are not geologists working for a university. They're oil company geologists, and they're looking for oil. Should they find promising pockets of oil in these sites, oil exploration, meaning exploratory oil wells come, and ultimately possibly fracking, production wells, possibly pipelines, tanker trucks going in and out.
And fracking is the explosive.
So let's go from, seismic is usually the initial phase of oil drilling. So seismic will help you to find the promising pockets. The next phase would be exploratory oil wells, where you actually go down to the depth where you think the oil is, drill a hole in the ground and see if there's any oil out there. If you see promising oil, and let's say you've gone down to that depth, you drill a horizontal hole, could be a mile long. At that point, you would kind of blow up. You would use chemicals under high pressure to blow up that hole, that borehole, and open up the surrounding ground around that borehole to try to extract the oil that's down there. And then turn it into a production well once you've got the stuff flowing and find some way of getting it to market. And that's...
Which could include pipelines.
Which could include pipelines. It could include tanker trucks, staging areas. But fracking itself, I mean, you're bringing in a lot of chemicals just to do that. You're bringing in a lot of chemicals just to do exploratory oil drilling. You've got to have drilling fluids, drilling mud, which is a combination of water and various chemicals. Fracking is much more corrosive, and you're pumping that stuff in under pressure. So, of course, people are also worried about impacts to the aquifer. And, of course, accidents that can happen out there, truck spills over, a blowout, underground blowouts, all kinds
of
things.
How did it happen that when the federal government took possession of the Big Cypress Preserve, that they didn't include that included mineral rights and let that reserve to the Colliers, of course, of Collier County and Barron Collier fame?
Right.
How is it they retained the mineral rights?
You know, that's a good question. The preserve was founded in 1974. And that was the way Congress authorized the enabling legislation, that they would obtain the surface rights, that the mineral rights would be left with the landowners, with the previous owners. They didn't spend any money.
Was there no idea that oil could be there?
I think there was, because there was already drilling. Drilling was already happening, and I think that was part of the motivation for retaining the oil rights. The Colliers were already inside the boundaries of the Big Cypress with not doing it themselves. I mean, the Colliers is not an oil company. Their development company, and they bring in outside people. At that time, it was Calumet that was drilling. Now they brought in another company, Brightburn, which, by the way, is in bankruptcy proceedings right now.
Well, the Colliers were instrumental in building the Tamiami Trail.
They were definitely instrumental in building
the trail. That's why it was named Collier County, because he gave so much money to complete that trail.
So there's no way around this, is there?
Well, there was a aborted buyout some years ago when the federal government had negotiated a buyout of the mineral rights, and various folks in the Senate, Congress, said, no, it's too expensive. I figured exactly the number. It was a couple hundred million dollars, I think, for the preserve mineral rights. That didn't go through. The Colliers are sitting on these mineral rights, and they say, we're not going to let it go to waste. I mean, these are folks who are...
Do they not look at the other environmental impact?
Their position in conversations that I've had with them about this issue is that we've been doing this for a long time. We know how to do this safely. We can do it safely. And this is a resource that we own, and we want to exploit it. that's their position, that we could do it safely and there's no, we have the right to do it. So let's do it.
All right, let's break here. We're speaking with Matthew Schwartz. He's the executive director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. We have a lot of ground to cover, so we'll take this short break and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with Matthew Schwartz. He's the executive director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you're certainly welcome. Our number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, please keep them short, radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Matthew, let's wrap up this big cypress business and get a little bit of a timetable of what we can expect of when there could be, when the court would look at whether to allow drilling.
Well, that would be, first they have to decide, they won't know until they actually drill. The seismic will give them, it's kind of like an ultrasound.
Contour.
It'll give them an idea. Like basically if the seismic signal bounces off some fluid level, they won't know exactly what's in that, but they have a good idea of what's there. I mean, seismic, from the discussions I've had with folks who do this work, it's evolved quite a bit. So their hit ratio is much better than it was in the past in terms of really being identify a oil deposit. Also, they're drilling within a known trend. They're drilling inside the Sunnyland trend. So northwest of where they're doing the seismic testing is Bear Island, and there is drilling there. Southeast is Raccoon Point. There is oil deposits there. They're drilling smack in the middle between those two oil fields. So I think they have a reasonable chance of finding something interesting from their point of view. If they're going to be drilling, they do have to send, they have to go through an entire permitting process all over again.
So we don't know how long this could take.
This is a multi-year project. Yeah. I mean, this is something that could take place over the course of decades. And they'll need a separate permit for each exploratory oil well that they drill.
Do you want to move on to Cantor Oil Well in Broward County?
Sure.
Okay.
That's an interesting one because that was one of those rare moments when DEP, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, so oil wells are generally permitted by the DEP. In this particular case, oil also has to be permitted by the National Park Service because it's taking place within a national preserve. But Cantor applied for an oil well about 5 miles west of the cities of Miramar and Pembroke Pines and was actually denied by the DEP. They decided that this was not a suitable place for drill for oil. The risk to the aquifer, risk to the Everglades, and the likelihood of finding oil in that location was not great. They denied the permit. I think it's one of the few times they actually did that. So there is good news here and there. There is good news. And I went up, and Cantor didn't take that lying down, and he decided to sue DEP for the denial.
And
we had a trial in June, and I was up in Tallahassee watching it as an observer, and it was very interesting. And DEP had their state geologist there, Tracy Woods, I think. And she did a great job of explaining the nature of the Biscayne Aquifer and how if you drill through this location that you could contaminate the Biscayne Aquifer, the sole source of drinking water for 6 million Floridians. Cantor was also trying to make the argument that the area was somehow hydrologically isolated because it was in between two canals, as if water does not flow directly through that karst geology underlying all of this area. The canal, both canals actually drain directly into Everglades National Park. So any contamination that got into these canals
would get into the park,
endangered species habitat, and it's just the wrong place to do it. But also what happened here, it wasn't just what the state statute calls the nature character of the lands involved. It was that Broward County really rose up in mass and said, we do not want this. And 20-something municipalities passed resolutions saying, this should not take place. The county itself passed an anti-fracking ordinance in response to Cantor. So it was really a big response.
Which brings up the question is if enough people objected to what they're doing in the Big Cypress Preserve, would that be effective? Could it be?
Yeah, you know.
I mean, can people be activists and it doesn't have an impact?
We've been activists for a long time on this issue. Yeah, many people have. The problem is the Park Service, I mean, they had one public meeting on this where they emphasized the Collier's right to use and enjoyment of their mineral holdings. And that's the term they use, use and enjoyment. This is something they own. We can't just take it away from them.
Right.
What we can do is make sure that they do it in the most environmentally safe way feasible, practicable, but not, we
if
don't have the right.
They're
saying we don't have the right to say no. That's their position. That this is a right that they're guaranteed.
So
by
it's
the
a done deal. It's just that the extent is still up for grabs.
And you never know how things turn out. I mean, we're going to try. We're going to resist. I mean, this is definitely something we're not going to.
What other organizations do you stand with?
Well, I think most environmental organizations are against this, and probably the most important terrestrial habitat left in South Florida, possibly in Florida, possibly in the United States. There's really nothing quite like the Big Cypress for biodiversity. But the organizations that were with us on the lawsuit was the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Parks Conservation Association, Conservancy of Southwest Florida, my organization, South Florida Wildlands Association, and another organization called Earthworks.
Explain how Big Cypress differs in ecology from Everglades National Park, the park being a part of the River of Grass.
Right. And the Big Cypress is what we call, many people call it the Big Cypress Swamp, the Big Cypress Basin, or the Western Everglades.
It's and self-sufficient on its water.
It is not part of that River of Grass, and therefore it's not part of the runoff. So it's not getting, if you look at the River of Grass starting south of Orlando, and you look at all the septic tanks, all those 2 million acres of cattle waste pouring into Lake Okeechobee, the 700,000 acres of the Everglades agricultural area, the Big Cypress participates in none of that. So Big Cypress waters are outstanding Florida waters. Mm. And we drink the water out there on long hikes. We bring a filter, just dunk it into the swamp, filter it out and drink it. No problem, ever. It's a big difference. It's also slightly higher than the Everglades, and it has a different topography. It has much more forest. It has a much greater variety of vegetation and terrains. We have pinelands, hardwood hammocks. It's in much better shape. It's more intact. And has a lot more wildlife.
And let's take a telephone call from some listeners. Tom in Plantation, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Joe. Bonnie, great program as always. I'm a regular listener. Matthew, this is Tom from the Swamp Apes. It's been a while.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good, man. I heard you on the radio, and I wanted to let the listeners know that you're the real deal.
Oh.
What you're doing for the Everglades is awesome. South Florida's wilderness is under assault. You know, we're down below 50% of the historic Everglades and the nature down there, and that 50% is under threat in all corners. And your voice and your advocacy, if anyone out there is on the fence about supporting your organization and understanding who you are, get off the fence, help Matthew. He is the best, and he's really a great, great advocate for what we have down here.
Thank you, Tom.
That's pretty
good. Thank you,
Tom.
Thank That's you, true. Guys. Keep Thank up you. The great work, Matthew.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
And we move along to Carmen in Pembroke Pines. Carmen, you're up. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to your show, and I enjoy it. It's very informative. I'm just giving a call because when you look at Broward County, it's like every little tiny piece of land sectioned off is being built on, and it's heartbreaking. The gentleman there, I'm sorry, forgive me, I forgot your name.
Matthew Schwartz.
Matthew, you went out to see all the destruction that has been taking place and has taken place with helicopters, et cetera. Why aren't these pictures on the Channel 7 news? Why aren't they on Channel 10? I just, like all the smaller things that are happening or behind the scenes that are happening, I feel like it's not being put in front of everyone. So there's enough anger between people in South Florida. They don't even know what's going on. And when I bring it up, they're like, what are you talking about? We're never going to have fracking here. And I'm like, are you kidding me? There are so many things happening and we're not even aware of it.
That's
everyone's
a good
so
point,
greedy. Yeah, everyone's so greedy, building. And it's like the greed's got to stop and we have to put our wildlife and our people first.
Carmen,
thank you for taking my call. I'll listen off air.
Okay, thank you, Carmen.
Thank you for your comments, Carmen. And you started off talking about development in Broward County, and I would recommend you going to Google and Googling the word Browardize. So Browardization is actually a kind of urban dictionary word.
It's a verb.
It's a noun. The Browardization would be, I guess, the noun.
The noun
Browardize
yes.
would be the verb. And Browardize means exactly what you described, is the covering over of every available inch of space. And of course, Broward County has reached its limit. When you go west of Broward County right now, you're getting into the water conservation areas. And that's the area that Cantor wants to drill in, actually. But he owns private property that's now under a state easement. Complicated. But the issue she brought in about the news.
Yeah, the other point.
That was the main point, is why isn't the news covering this? And the news does cover it. I mean, if you read the Miami Herald, Jenny Stiletovich from the Miami Herald, Eric Statz from the Naples News, David Fleshler from the Sun Sentinel, all of them have written articles about both of these stories, Burnett and Cantor. They're in the newspaper. Yeah, we don't get a lot of TV news on it. But the news cycle is what it is. I mean, it goes from Russiagate and Michael Flynn to possible nuclear war with Korea to what happened this weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. And these sensational stories tend to grab attention. And habitat loss, habitat degradation, fragmentation is just not that juicy. I think it's borne out before every election. They do surveys. They ask voters what's important to you.
Yeah,
what are your priorities? If they don't mention the environment, it's never even mentioned.
So what if it became our drinking water? I mean, then that affects everybody if our drinking water is endangered.
And I think that's what the Cantor well, the huge response from all the Broward municipalities to the Cantor well was they were drilling through the Biscayne Aquifer, and people did get excited about it. And obviously that had an effect because DEP did deny the permit. They actually wrote a draft permit and then switched it over to do a denial. And clearly, we think that the pressure we and all the volunteers and all the municipalities applied to Tallahassee made a big difference. So it requires that.
Again, our number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org. One more caller here, Enrique Sunny Isles. You're up. Hi.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Like every other caller said, really appreciate your program, and I listen every day, and I love it. Thank you for continuing. Now, my point is, first, is are you kidding me? Are you crazy? Don't you know we have, under our soil, we have limestone all over. We're known for our sinkholes everywhere, and if we're going to start fragmentating, throwing chemicals with pressure, what can you expect? Nothing else than just having more and more disasters happening everywhere. And unfortunately, all this that we're talking is just the result of what I think is the main problem, which is our politics. You know, where unfortunately we live in a legalized corruption called lobbying, and the biggest lobbyists are the oil companies, are the people that are only caring about greed and profit. They're not looking to our best interest. In my little town, Sunny Isles, there's about 20-some thousand condominiums built. The last election, it was on a Tuesday, and I think we had 600 people showing up to vote. So it's, you know, how could we change this if we don't do something addressed directly to the point? You know, we need to change the ways that we are conducting our government. It's not working right. It's not working for our best interest. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Enrique.
Thank you, Enrique. And I think that, again, you're emphasizing the development factor and all the stresses that that puts on our environment in many ways, which I would say is, if I had to compare fracking and the oil industry to the development industry, fracking and oil would be a very distant second. I think that the impacts on our environment, from paving over what's left of the Everglades, the water use that we use, the wastewater we produce.
Much of that water is diverted to canals and then out to sea.
And out to sea. I mean, most of the Everglades, I mean, you look at the, you know, kind of like the guts of the Everglades is the canals running off of Lake Okeechobee, taking the massive amounts of fresh water that used to pour into the Everglades out into the Atlantic Ocean for the benefit of having dry land.
Norman wants to know, he says, it seems that fracking would not be of use in Southwest Florida due to the porous soil and low-density limestone structure. What moves through the ground, water moves through the ground structure, so why wouldn't the fracking pressure just leak out?
Well, we're talking about oil is found in Southwest Florida in a very, we're talking about 11,000, 12,000 feet, and the limestone at that depth is a lot denser than the limestone that we're seeing on the surface. It's not that really soft, porous stuff. It's still limestone, but under 12,000 feet of pressure, it's a lot denser. And in fact, the one case where an oil well was fracked in southwest Florida. It was the Collier Hogan well several years ago. It did turn it into a production well. Fracking works. I mean, there's no question the fracking technology, if you're a driller, pumping, you know, you've got a 6-inch borehole running horizontally into the ground at 12,000, 11,000, 12,000 feet down, blowing that open with high-pressure chemicals, cracking open that rock is going to release oil. So technologically it works, but I think that we share the same fears that all the callers do. What
does oil exploration have a benefit to lower gas prices at least?
No, the oil that's produced, I mean, we've produced 120 million barrels of oil out of the Big Cypress region since 1943. The United States uses 20 million barrels a day, 6 days worth of supply from 1943 to 2017. It's a negligible amount of oil. It's not even oil that's used in gasoline. It's a very heavy oil. It's used in tar, grease products, et cetera.
Probably plastics.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly, yeah. But it goes out into the market. But this is not going to
be refined for different uses.
Yeah, I mean, mainly the motivation is that somebody owns this right and they want to benefit from it. That's the benefit, really, that's out there for the owner.
All right, another short break on today's Topical Currents, speaking with Matthew Schwartz, Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with Matthew Schwartz, the Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. Matthew, let's turn to Turkey Point and underground storage for two nuclear reactors that are written about.
Yeah, well, FPL, if you look at their portfolio, their energy portfolio, the largest share of the energy they produce is natural gas. It's somewhere close to 70%. It's about 20% nuclear that comes from the Turkey Point nuclear plant and the the plant at St. Lucie. And the rest is a mixture of coal. There's still some coal left in the mix and energy that they buy that's typically waste to energy. We burn our garbage here in South Florida, and we use that to convert that to energy. And there's some negligible amount of solar in their mix. Turkey Point would more than double the capacity of the Turkey Point nuclear plant. It would be two nuclear reactors over 1,000 megawatts each. They have gotten preliminary approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their they've got an improved environmental impact statement that it's not going to cause significant harm, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Do you agree with that?
No, I think it's a ludicrous place to build a nuclear plant. For, you know, I could mention many, many reasons. But the biggest reason that comes to mind for me is that in 1992, when Hurricane Andrew came right through Turkey Point and made a direct hit on Turkey Point, there was significant damage. There's one access road that goes out to Turkey Point. It was closed. All outside power was lost. All outside communication was lost. One of the chimneys that are used for one of the fossil fuel plants on the site was damaged to the point it had to be taken down. The only reason why Turkey Point didn't turn into a Fukushima was that the backup generators worked. You can't just turn off a nuclear plant. You've got to have water flowing through the core reactor and the spent fuel rods to keep those that stuff cool. If it's not cooled off, you'll have a meltdown. That's what happened in Fukushima, was that the generators that would normally run water through the spent fuel rods and the reactor core were not working due to the tsunami, and they had a meltdown. That would have been a horrific experience. To say that that couldn't happen, to say, well, that didn't happen. They said it didn't. So Turkey Point hit, and the nuclear plant survived it. But what if it didn't?
Right.
What if it didn't? Plus, there's all kinds of you have existing problems with the 5,000 acres of cooling canals at Turkey Point, pouring salt water into the underlying aquifer, releasing tritium into Biscayne Bay.
Which we've done shows about.
Which we've talked about right? And now the new plant is not going to use those cooling canals are at capacity. The two new nuclear plants they're going to build there are going to use cooling towers, which is going to run about 80 million gallons a day of recycled Miami-Dade sewage through the plant for cooling, and then basically cool them off with the cooling towers, which will release steam into the surrounding area. That steam is not going to be pure H2O. All kinds of constituents could be in there, aerosols.
Well, you're saying droplets. They're using sewage to...
They're using recycled cleanup sewage. Okay. Cool the new proposed plant. And then once they've used this water, they're going to pump it down again below the aquifer into the boulder zone. in an area that's going to be underwater. Turkey Point area is 6 inches above sea level. The very first part of Miami-Dade that's going to flood is the area surrounding Turkey Point. So I think for many reasons it's a ludicrous project. I'm sorry that that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave it its permit. The company that was going to build the two new reactors, Westinghouse, is out of the business. The AP1000 reactors, they're in bankruptcy. They're not going to be building those. They're going to have to look for a new contractor or build them themselves. So for many, many reasons, I think that this is a project that shouldn't go forward.
Okay, on one more energy front is the Sabal Trail pipeline.
Sabal Trail pipeline. So, you know, I looked at this the other day as I was, we were preparing this program, and I looked at the map of gas pipelines coming into Florida next to a map of our major highways. And what I found is that they're pretty similar. So you've got the Florida gas transmission pipeline running across basically where I-10 is, coming from Texas across the Florida Panhandle and then down into Florida. It runs along both the East Coast, West Coast, parallel to 95 in southern Florida, bringing gas to all points. There's a spur that goes off into Jacksonville. It runs down the East Coast. It runs the West Coast. You've got another pipeline called the Gulfstream Pipeline that runs from Mobile across the Gulf of Mexico to Tampa Bay and into Central Florida. And now you've got the new Sabal Trail Pipeline, which is kind of taking the place of the Florida Turnpike. So if you overlay the Florida highway system, basically where people live, over these pipelines,
where the pipelines
are. You'll see pretty much they're, you know, and Sabal Trail is, of course, the newest one. That connects into what's called the Transco pipeline. Transco goes from Texas all the way to New York, and the Sabal Trail plugs into it in Alabama, runs down into Central Florida, where they're creating a new hub where all these pipelines are going to come together in a massive compressor station. And then they're building what's called, or they've already built it, the Southeast Connection Pipeline, which goes south from Orlando down to another big gas plant in Martin County. And now they're building another, actually people who are concerned about the Sabal Trail Pipeline should know that the company has applied for a lateral pipeline going to the Okeechobee Clean Energy Center. That's another new gas plant that they're building. So FPNL has built natural gas electrical generating plants all through their region. They've got another one in the works that's a little bit further along or not quite as far along, called the Hendry County Clean Energy Center. That's going to be 3,750 megawatts, equal to the West County Energy Center right next to the Loxahatchee. This one is
so
right.
All this energy that's being created, is this because of they can't keep up with the growth?
They claim that this is needed for new growth. Exactly. I mean, we're 20 million people in Florida. You talked about that in the beginning, that we're a growing state. We're 20 million people. I've said that before in this program. We're the third largest state in the country. We surpassed New York in 2014. We're growing at about 1,000 people a day. The FWC and 1,000 Friends of Florida worked off a report called Florida 2060, which predicts 36 million people in the state of Florida by the year 2060.
So we're talking about doubling.
We're talking about...
Just about.
Yeah, doubling. Going, well, the report was written when the population was 18 million. We're talking about
right.
going to 36 million.
So going to 40 million.
It looked like a joke when I first saw it, but look around and we could kind of segue from that into the Panther, because that's really a good place to segue when we're talking about, you know, the Florida Panther, our state animal. Nobody's going to discover a cure for the Panther. Everybody knows the Panther's problem. The Panther is running out of habitat, running out of available habitat. And all of this growth, new highways, new pipelines, new power plants, new electrical transmission, we didn't even talk about that, was that the new electrical lines that would go from Turkey Point along the east side of Everglades National Park. Thank you to Miami-Dade County, because you sued and you won. And in fact, the Florida appellate court ruled that no, you have environmental rules that govern that land, and FPNL cannot build power transmission lines across that side of Everglades National Park.
And they could be put underground.
Well, not in Everglades National Park. So there was actually...
But the ones that run up the coast towards Coral Gables.
The ones that were going to run along US 1 could be undergrounded, not the massive ones that were going to run along through the wetlands.
So what are they? What's going to happen?
It's FPNL's problem. They lost that right, and the Florida Supreme Court refused to hear that case. So Miami-Dade County essentially won. They said, we have environmental ordinance covering that piece of land, and power transmission lines are not compatible with it. They try FBNL, interestingly, they tried to do an end run around that decision. In the last legislative session, they actually tried to get the legislator to pass a bill that would make it illegal for a local government to try to rule against transmission lines, that would be basically out of their league. And nobody, it didn't go, I think it went through the Senate. It died in committee in the House, and that was a good thing as well.
So stick with the Florida Panther for a bit.
All right. So let's
talk. So it's being reviewed, under review, whether it should be taken off the endangered species.
Well, okay. So a five-year review, all endangered species go through a five-year review process. The last one that was done for the Florida Panther was done, I think, in 2009. I think it was in 2009. So we're eight years beyond it. And now they're doing the five-year review. A review could lead to a number of different outcomes. For a threatened species, it could be moved to endangered. An endangered species, that would be upgraded or uplisted. An endangered species could be downlisted to threatened. It could be delisted, meaning it's just taken off the endangered species list completely. Or in this case, it could be just its status of endangered would be left as is, and that's what we're recommending, that the Florida panther remain an endangered species.
If it were taken off the endangered species protection, if that were delisted, or if it were delisted.
Delisted.
Yeah. So what would that mean?
Well, it would lose all of its protections under the Endangered Species Act.
What protections does it have?
And protections against take, for example. That means no hunting, shooting, harassing, harming, pursuing, collecting, et cetera. That's one of the prohibitions. But also, when you develop the habitat for an endangered species, obviously that's a major consideration. Is that development going to cause the species to go extinct? The entire purpose of the Endangered Species Act, it acknowledges that through economic development, unconscious economic development, essentially we've lost many species in the United States. And what we're trying to do is protect these species. We need to be able to protect the habitat. If a particular project is going to cause jeopardy, which means that the possibility of the species going extinct, the Fish and Wildlife Service has an obligation to deny that project going forward.
Well, the panther has been in such bad shape for decades. I remember they were bringing in a form of cougar that could actually mate with the panther to try to keep the species alive. There were only about 200 of them left, or 20 of them left at that time.
That's correct, Joe. And if we go back to the mid-90s, that was pretty much the situation. We were down to about 20, 30 panthers. We think there was maybe only two males doing all the reproduction.
They were busy.
They were busy, but they had a very inbred clan.
Right.
And an inbred clan is
so
not...
So they brought in those outside cougars genetically compatible.
Eight female Texas cougars. But if you look at, I mean, you really have to step back again a little bit on this first. The cougar, panther, puma, mountain lion once ranged over the entire United States, continental United States, all the way up to the Yukon and all the way down to Patagonia in South America, the most wide-ranging mammal in our hemisphere. Through hunting, because the panther, cougar, mountain lion was viewed as a nuisance animal, a danger to livestock, through habitat loss, habitat fragmentation, eventually the only cougar mountain lion left in the eastern United States was our Florida panther. And the reason for that is up until recently, that area was essentially off limits.
Right.
There's nothing good about South Florida for panthers.
Actually, the habitat that it's in now is not really its natural habitat. It was a species of the coastal ridge.
It's a habitat generalist. It could live in deserts. It could live in mountains. It could live, like I said, it could live in the Amazon. It could live in the. It can adapt. It can adapt to many, many habitats. It's that it's not ideal because the prey base is low, the vegetation is wrong for deer. It would be much better off in the mountains north of Atlanta.
We'll talk about August 29th before we take our break.
Okay, so August 29th is the deadline for comments where people could weigh in on whether or not the panther, you know, what they think the status review should be. And we're recommending folks say that the panther is still in a lot of trouble. We haven't even talked about the dozen or so development projects going on right now in the works in panther habitat. We think that the prognosis for panthers in the future is grim. There's one single breeding population. It could be wiped out by disease. It's shrinking. Yes, the Texas cougars bringing them into Florida helped increase the population, But from 95 until now, we've probably lost another 100,000 acres or so of panther habitat. So we've got a larger population living
in a smaller
in
area.
A smaller area.
So where do people comment?
Okay, so what I'm going to suggest, because I have, first of all, they can go to my Facebook page, which is just find South Florida Wildlands Association on Facebook.
Okay.
And it's linked to the post on today's program because I did announce this on the program. But I'm going to give you an email. That's the easiest way. And this is David Schindel. And David Schindel is the Florida Panther Coordinator for the South Florida Ecological Services Field Office. But mainly all you need is his email. And David's email is David, D-A-V-I-D, underscore Schindel, S-H-I-N-D-L-E, at fws.gov. And that would be the easiest way for you to submit comments. If you're familiar with the area, if you know what's happening with the panther, give him your substantive information about how you think panthers should be managed and what status they should have.
And we'll try to have a link to that
okay.
on our website. Matthew Schwartz, Executive Director of South Florida Wildlands Association. Our last break. We'll be right back.
Back, it's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Matthew Schwartz. He's the Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. Matthew, let's continue to talk about the Florida panther. This is just something that has to be done, the renew, but there's no sign that this is actually going to be taking the panther off the endangered species list. I mean, it's not like panthers are attacking kids or cattle that they're a nuisance by any means.
No, in fact, there's never been a documented attack on a human being by a Florida panther, which is an interesting difference between...
So it's just procedural, this is, then?
Well, it's procedural, but it's also... No, I mean, it's basically looking at the panther's current status, but also means its current situation, and making recommendations as to how the species should be managed. Our recommendation, in addition to not delisting the panther or not downlisting it from endangered to threatened, is for the Fish and Wildlife Service to become a regulatory agency. One of the problems with the panther is that it's not really the Florida panther. The Florida panther is the Collier, Lee, and Hendry County panther. To a lesser extent, it's the Palm Beach County panther. Now and then, a panther will cross the Caloosahatchee River and move into central Florida or northern Florida. We've actually this year documented for the first time three females north of the Caloosahatchee River. Technically, under the current recovery plan for the panther, they would need three separate populations of 240 animals each to consider the panther completely recovered. If they were to get two populations of 240 each, you would have a situation where they could move it to threatened. The current situation is we have one population, which may be at 240. It may be as low as 100, 120. We don't really know the exact number. We definitely don't have a second population yet in central Florida or northern Florida, and there's no even inkling of a third population. So the panther is relegated to a very small space in southwest Florida. That habitat is being diminished by the day. There's a project going through right now, it used to be the town of Big Cypress, now it's been changed. I guess people found that to be not such a good name for a community since it's already the name of a national preserve. So they call it Rural Lands West. That's going to be 4,000 acres of new development right next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. FPNL is, of course, building the Hendry County Clean Energy Center just north of the Big Cypress in primary Florida panther habitat. Corkscrew Farms in panther habitat, Wild Blue, I think that's another one right inside panther habitat, road widenings everywhere. The panther, and each one of these projects does not raise to what the Fish and Wildlife Service considers jeopardy. I mean, each one of these projects by itself is
not... Yeah, but what about combined?
Exactly.
I mean, can't they see the whole picture?
People need to tell that. Fish and Wildlife Service, start paying attention to cumulative impacts and start ruling that each one of these things by itself may not be sufficient, but together they are sufficient. And stop looking at these piecemeal, and basically we need to... The science is clear. Two scientific reports, Fracas et al., Kautz et al., have determined that the panther needs every square inch of habitat it still has. We can't lose any of it in quality or quantity. And we're not following best available science. Allowing these lands, these folks bought rural lands, allowing these lands to be rezoned and changed for dense developments. Dense development, dense urban development means Naples grows out. It doesn't mean you leapfrog from Naples all the way out to these rural lands and start building new communities, new urban communities spread out throughout the panther's habitat and roads to connect them. We lost 42 panthers in 2015, 42 in 2016, most to roadkill, a smaller amount due to intraspecific aggression, panthers fighting over habitats, fighting over territories. And more people, more population, more roads is just going to lead to more roadkill and a diminishment of the population.
We have a listener who wants you to repeat the Panther email address.
Okay. And we're going to have it on the website.
Okay. So, again, this is the Panther coordinator. And let me just go right to his name is David Schindel. And David's email is David, D-A-V-I-D, underscore Schindel, S-H-I-N-D-L-E, at FWS.gov. That's F like Frank, W like William, S like Sam, FWS.gov.
As in Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife Service, exactly.
Okay, and I'm just giving this so that it'll be on our website. In our last, I can't believe the show is, we're almost out of time, but let's talk about environmentalism. For you, for those who are fighting the good fight in this time of deregulation locally, regionally, and nationally. I mean, it's a difficult time, and it's at the time when climate change seems to be accelerating. So what could be a worse combination?
You said it. So what comes to mind is the opening line of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, but leave off the first part.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. That's really where we are. I mean, we've got a governor who ran under environmental regulations of jobs killers. His first big action as governor was getting rid of the Department of Community Affairs, which was our one growth watchdog agency who could actually declare a development to be sprawl and rule against it. That's gone. We now have replaced that with the Department of Economic Opportunity. Anything a county government sends for approval to Tallahassee will be approved, and we're seeing it. We're seeing development everywhere. On the federal level, I can't even keep up with it. There's a new environmental regulation overturned almost by the day.
The New York Times published the 23 environmental rules rolled back in the first 100 days of the Trump administration.
And we've had another 100 days since,
yeah,
with more than 23 that
and
have been rolled back.
And just to be clear, there were some environmental no-nos that Obama also did. We're not picking...
No, we're not being partisan here. I mean,
right.
And in fact, the lawsuit against Burnett was a lawsuit against Obama administration. The Obama administration also approved the Sable Trail pipeline, his federal agency.
Right.
He approved many pipelines. He opened up offshore Alaska to oil drilling. This is not something unique to Donald Trump, but we are, at least Obama said the right things, if nothing else. He said the right things about climate change, even if his actions weren't always the best.
But it's accelerating.
It's accelerating because we're in denial. Right now we're in denial, and it seems like we want to go back to to before all the environmental regulations, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, the Wilderness Act, Endangered Species Act. We're cutting Endangered Species Act, that's under attack right now. There is legislation out there in Congress which would make recovery plans and listing decisions up to approval by individual states, not by the federal government, not using best available science, using whatever states wanted. And many times states are hostile to endangered species protection because they're looking at economic development as more important, as we see happening in Florida.
Matthew Schwartz, Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. Matt holds master's degrees in counseling and sociology. He's educator, researcher, counselor. Also well known in South Florida for his guided swamp walks to the Big Cypress National
Reserve. Which I don't have time for anymore.
I'm sure, and other public lands. We'll have a link to David Schindel at the Fish and Wildlife Service on our website, WLRN.org, where we'll also have today's show posted a little later than usual, I believe. Thank you, Matthew, and thanks for all your work.
Thank you, Bonnie and Bob, and everybody out there for supporting this work.
And thanks for tuning in this hour.
Okay.
Our program was produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Jason Zabka composes our online content. Polly Landis is associate producer. Of course, it's easy to download free audio archives of each program at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is a swinging hour with the incredible Tito Puente Jr. Besides keeping the legacy of his famous multiple Grammy-winning father alive, he's booked for constant live performances. We'll also hear from singer, songwriter, and dancer Melina Almodovar, La Chica del Bling. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.